From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Glove by Fritz Lieber Jr. My most literally tangible brush with the supernatural, something I can get incredibly infatuated with yet forever distrust profoundly, like a very beautiful and adroit call girl, occurred in connection with a rape by a masked intruder of the woman who lived in the next apartment to mine during my San Francisco years. I knew Evelyn Maine only as a neighbor, and I slept through the whole incident, including the arrival and departure of the police, though there came a point in the case when the police doubted both these assertions of mine. The phrase, victim of rape, calls up certain stereotyped images. An attractive young woman going home alone late at night enters a dark street, is grabbed, or a beautiful young suburban matron, mother of three, wakes after midnight, feels a nameless dread, is grabbed. The truth is apt to be less romantic. Evelyn Maine was 65, long divorced, neglected, and thoroughly detested by her two daughters-in-law, and only to a lesser degree by their husbands, lived on various programs of old age, medical and psychiatric assistance, was scrawny, gloomy, alcoholic, waspish, believed life was futile and either overdosed on sleeping pills or else lightly cut her wrist 3 or 4 times a year. Her assailant, at least, was somewhat more glamorous in a sick way. The rapist was dressed all in rather close-fitting gray, hands covered by gray gloves, face obscured by a long shock of straight silver hair falling over it, and in the left hand, at first, a long knife that gleamed silver in the dimness. And she wasn't grabbed either, at first, but only commanded in a harsh whisper, coming through the hair, to lie quietly or be cut up. And she was alone again at last. She silently waited something like the 10 minutes she'd been warned to, thinking that at least she hadn't been cut up, or else, who knows, wishing she had been. Then she went next door in the opposite direction to mine and roused Marcia Everly, who was a buyer for a department store and about half her age. After the victim had been given a drink, they called the police and Evelyn Maine's psychiatrist, and also her social worker, who knew her current doctor's number, which she didn't, but they couldn't get hold of either the last two. Marcia suggested waking me, and Evelyn Maine countered by suggesting they wake Mr. Helpful, who has the next room beyond Marcia's down the hall. Mr. Helpful, otherwise nicknamed Baldy, I never remembered his real name, was someone I loathed because he was always prissily dancing around, being neighborly and asking if there was something he could do, and because he was 6'4" tall, while I am rather under average height. Marcia Everly is also very tall, at least for a woman, but as it happens, I do not loathe her in the least. Quite the opposite, in fact. But Evelyn Maine said I wasn't sympathetic. Well, Marcia, thank goodness, loathed Mr. Helpful as much as I do. She thought him a weirdo, along with half the other tenants in the building. So they compromised by waking neither of us. And until the police came, Evelyn Maine simply kept telling the story of her rape over and over, rather mechanically, while Marcia listened dutifully and occupied her mind as to which of our crazy fellow tenants was the best suspect. Granting it hadn't been done by an outsider, although that seemed likeliest. The three most colorful were the statuesque platinum blonde drag queen on the third floor, The long-haired old weirdo on six who wore a cape and was supposed to be into witchcraft, and the tall, silver-haired, Nazi-looking lesbian on seven, assuming she wore a dildo for the occasion and was nuttier than a $5 fruitcake. Ours really is a weird building, you see. And not just because its occupants sometimes seem as if they were all referred here by mental hospitals. No, it's eerie in its own right. You see, several decades ago it was a hotel with all the rich, warm inner life that once implied bevies of maids who actually used the linen closets, empty now, on each floor and the round, snap-capped outlets in the baseboards for a vacuum system that hadn't been operated for a generation, and the two dumbwaiters, their doors forever shut and painted over. In the old days there had been bellboys and an elevator operator and two night porters who carried up drinks and midnight snacks from a restaurant that never closed. But they're gone now, every last one of them, leaving the halls empty feeling and very gloomy, and the stairwell an echoing void, and the lobby funeral, so that the most solitary tenants of today are apt to seem like ghosts, especially when you meet one coming silently around a turn in the corridor where the ceiling lights burnt out. Sometimes I think that, what with the smaller and smaller families and more people living alone, our whole modern world is getting like that. The police finally arrived, two grave and solicitous young men, making a good impression, especially a tall and stalwart, Marcia told me, Officer Hart. But when they first heard Evelyn Main's story, they were quite skeptical. Marcia could tell, or thought she could, she told me. But they searched Evelyn's room and poked around the fire escapes and listened to her story again, and then they radioed for a medical policewoman who arrived with admirable speed and who decided after an examination that in all probability there had been recent sex, which would be confirmed by analysis of some smears she'd taken from the victim and the sheets. Officer Hart did two great things, Marcia said. He got hold of Evelyn Main's social worker and told him he'd better get on over quick, and he got from him the phone number of her son, who lived in the city, and called him up and threw a scare into his wife and him about how they were the nearest of kin. God damn it, and had better start taking care of the abused and neglected lady. Meanwhile, the other cop had been listening to Evelyn Main, who was still telling it, and he asked her innocent questions and had got her to admit that earlier that night she'd gone alone to a bar down the street, a rather rough place, and had one drink, or maybe three. Which made me wonder, Marcia said she could tell, whether Evelyn hadn't brought the whole thing on herself. Maybe by inviting some man home with her, and then inventing the rape, at least in part, when things went wrong. Though I couldn't see her inventing the silver hair. Anyhow, the police got her statements and got his sign and then took off, even more solemnly sympathetic than they arrived, Officer Hart in particular. Of course, I didn't know anything about all this when I knocked on Marcia's door before going to work that morning to confirm a tentative movie date we'd made for that evening. Though I was surprised when the door opened and Mr. Helpful came out looking down at me very thoughtfully, his bald head gleaming, and saying to Marcia in the voice adults use when children are listening, "I'll keep in touch with you about the matter. If there's anything I can do, don't hesitate." Marcia, looking at him very solemnly, nodded. And then my feeling of discomfiture was completed when Evelyn Main, empty glass in hand and bathrobe clutched around her, edged past me as if I were contagious, giving me a peculiarly hostile look and calling back to Marcia over my head, "I'll come back, my dear, when I've repaired my appearance so that people can't say you're entertaining bedraggled old hags." I was relieved when Marcia gave me a gin as soon as the door was closed and said, "Actually, she's gone to get herself another drink, after finishing off my supply." "But really, Jeff, she has a reason to this morning. and for hating any man she runs into. And her face grew grave and troubled, and a little frightened too, as she quickly clued me in on the night's nasty events. Mr. Helpful, she explained, had dropped by to remind them about a tenants' meeting that evening, and when he got the grisly news, to go into song and dance about how shocked he was and how guilty at having slept through it all, and what could he do? Once she broke off to ask, almost worriedly, "What I can't understand, Jeff, is why any man would want to rape someone like Evelyn." I shrugged. "Kinky some way, I suppose. Doesn't matter. You know, to old women, I mean, maybe a mother thing?" "Maybe he hates women," she speculated. "Wants to punish them." I nodded. She had finished by the time Evelyn Maine came back, very listless now, looking like a woebegone ghost, dropped into a chair. She hadn't gotten dressed or even combed her hair. In one hand, she had her glass full and dark, and in the other a large, pale, gray leather glove, which she carried oddly, dangling it by one finger. Marcia started to ask her about it, but she just began to recite once more all that had happened to her that night, in an unemotional, mechanical voice that sounded as if it would go on forever. "Look, I didn't like the woman. She was a particularly useless, venomous sort of nuisance. Those were some suicide attempts. But that recital got to me. I found myself hating the person who would deliberately put someone into the state she was in. I realized, perhaps for the first time, just what a vicious and sick crime rape is, and how cheap are all the easy jokes about it." Eventually, the glove came into the narrative naturally. And in order to do that, he had to take off his glove. He was particularly excited just then, and it must have got shoved behind the couch and forgotten, where I found it just now. Marcia pounced on the glove at once, then, saying it was important evidence they must tell the police about. So she called them, and after a bit she managed to get Officer Hart himself, and he told her to tell Evelyn Maine to hold on to the glove, and he'd send someone over for it eventually. It was more than time for me to get out to work, but I stayed until she finished her call because I wanted to remind her about our date that evening. She begged off, saying she'd be too tired from the sleep she'd lost, and anyway, she decided to go to the tenants' meeting tonight, she told me. "This has made me realize that I've got to begin taking some responsibility for what happens around me. We may make fun of such people, the good neighbors, but they've got something solid about them." I was pretty miffed at that, though I don't think I let it show. Oh, I didn't so much mind her turning me down. There were reasons enough. But she didn't have to make such a production of it and drag in good neighbors. Mr. Helpful, who else? Besides, Evelyn Maine came out of her sad apathy long enough to give me a big smile when Marcia said no. So I didn't go to the tenants' meeting that night, as I might otherwise have done. Instead, I had dinner out and went to the movie. It was lousy. And then had a few drinks, so that it was late when I got back. No signs of life in the lobby, or lift, or corridor, and gratefully piled into bed. I was dragged out of the depth of sleep, that first blissful plunge, by a persistent knocking. I shouted something angry but unintelligible, and when there was no reply, made myself get up, feeling furious. It was Marcia. With a really remarkable effort, I kept my mouth shut and even smoothed out whatever expression was contorting my face. The words one utters on being suddenly awakened, especially from that matchless first sleep that is never recaptured, can be as disastrous as speaking in drink. Our relationship had progressed to the critical stage, and I sure didn't want to blow it, especially when treasures I'd hoped to win were spread out in front of my face, as it were, under a semi-transparent nightgown and hastily thrown on negligee. I looked up a little at her face. Her eyes were wide. She said in a sort of frightened little girl voice that didn't seem at all put on, "I'm awfully sorry to wake you up at 3 o'clock in the morning Jeff, but would you keep this spooky for me? I can't get to sleep with it in my room. It is a testimony to the very high quality of Marcia's treasures that I didn't until then notice that she was carrying in front of her, in a fold of toilet paper, the pale gray leather glove Evelyn Mayne had found behind her couch. Huh? I said, not at all brilliantly. Didn't Officer Hart come back or send someone over to pick it up? She shook her head. Evelyn had it, of course. While I was at my job, her social worker did come over right after you left, but then at supper time her son and daughter-in-law came. Officer Hart did scare them, and bolted her off to the hospital, and she left a glove with me. I called the police, but Officer Hart was off duty, and Officer Halstead, whom I talked to, told me they'd be over to pick it up early in the morning. Please take it, Jeff. Whenever I look at it, I think of that crazy sneaking around with the silver hair down his face and waving the knife. It keeps giving me the shivers. I looked again at her spooky in its fold of tissue, so that she wouldn't have to touch it, what other reason? And, you know, it began to give me the shivers. Just an old glove. But now it had an invisible gray aura radiating from it. Okay, I said, closing my hand on it with an effort, and went on ungraciously, really, without thinking. Though I wonder you didn't ask Mr. Helpful first, what with all his offers and seeing him at the meeting. Well, I asked you, she said a little angrily, then her features relaxed into a warm smile. Thanks, Jeff. Only then did it occur to me that here I was passing up, in my sleep-soddenness, what might be a priceless opportunity. Well, that could be corrected. But before I could invite her in, there came this sharp little cough, or clearing of the throat. We both turned, and there was Mr. Helpful in front of his open door, dressed in pajamas and a belted maroon dressing gown. He came smiling and dancing toward us. He didn't really dance, but he gave that impression in spite of being 6'4", and saying, "Could I be of any assistance, Miss Everly? Did something alarm you? Is there a..." He hesitated as if there might be something he should be embarrassed at. Marcia shook her head curtly and said to me quite coolly, "No, thank you. I needn't come in, Mr. Winter. That will be fine. Good night." I realized Baldy had managed to embarrass her, and that she was making it clear that we weren't parting after a rendezvous, or about to have one. But to use my last name? As she passed him, she gave him a formal nod. He hurried back to his own door, a highlight dancing on the back of his head. "Marcia says he shaves it. I, that he doesn't have to." I waited until I heard her double lock her door and slide the bolt across. Then I looked grimly at Baldy until he'd gone inside and closed his. I had that pleasure. Then I retired myself, tossed the glove down on some sheets of paper on the table in front of the open window, threw myself into bed, and switched out the light. I fully expected to send considerable time being furious at my hulking, mincing, officious neighbor, and maybe at Marcia too, before I could get to sleep. But somehow my mind took off on a fantasy about the building around me, as it might have been a half century ago. Ghostly bellboys sped silently with little notes inviting or accepting rendezvous. Ghostly waiters wheeled noiseless carts of silver-covered suppers for two. Pert, ghostly maids whirled ghostly sheets through the dark air as they made the bed, their smiles suggesting they might substitute for non-arriving sweethearts. The soft darkness whirlpooled. Somewhere was wind. I woke with a start as if someone or something had touched me, and I sat up in bed. And then I realized that something was touching me high on my neck, just below my ear. Something long, like a finger laid flatter. Oh God, a centipede? I remembered how centipedes were supposed to cling with their scores of tiny feet. And this was clinging. As a child, I'd been terrified by a tropical centipede that had come weaving out of a stalk of new-bought bananas in the kitchen, and the memory still returned full force once in a great while. Now it galvanized me into whirling my hand behind my head and striking my neck a great brushing swipe, making my jaw and ear sting. I instantly turned on the light and rapidly looked all around me without seeing anything close to me that might have brushed off my neck. I thought I'd felt something with my hand when I'd done that, but I couldn't be sure. And then I looked at the table by the window and saw that the glove was gone. Almost at once, I got the vision of it lifting up and floating through the air at me, fingers first, or else dropping off the table and inching across the floor and up the bed. I don't know which was worse. The thing on my neck had felt leathery. My immediate impulse was to check if my door was still shut. I couldn't tell from where I sat. A very tall clothes cabinet abuts the door, shutting the view of it from the head of the bed. So I pushed my way down the bed, putting my feet on the floor after looking down to make sure there was nothing in the immediate vicinity. And then a sharp gust of wind came in the window and blew the last sheet of paper off the table and deposited it on the floor near the other sheets of paper and the glove and the tissue now disentangled from it. I was so relieved I almost laughed. I went over and picked up the glove, feeling a certain revulsion, but only at the thought of who had worn it and what had been involved in. I examined it closely, which I hadn't done earlier. It was rather thin gray kid, a fairly big glove and stretched still further, as if a pretty big hand had worn it, but quite light enough to have blown off the table with the papers. There were grimy streaks on in a slightly stiff part where some fluid had dried, and a faintly reddish streak that might have been lipstick. And it looked old, decades old. I put it back on the table and set a heavy ashtray on top of it and got back in bed feeling suddenly secure again. It occurred to me how the empty fingers of a gray leather glove is really very much like a centipede, some of the larger of which are the same size, flat and yellowish gray, though the one that had come out of the banana stalk had been bright red. But these thoughts were no longer frightening. I looked a last time across the room at the glove, pinioned under the heavy ashtray, and I confidently turned off the light. Sleep was longer in coming this time, however. I got my fantasy of hotel ghosts going again, but gloves kept coming into it. The lissom maids wore work ones as they rhythmically polished piles of ghostly silver. The bellboy's hands holding the ghostly notes were gloved in pale gray cotton. And there were opera gloves, almost armpit length, that looked like spectral white cobras, especially when they were drawn inside out off the sinuous, snake-slender arms of wealthy guesting ladies. And other ghostly gloves, not all hotel ones, came floating and weaving into my fantasy. The black gloves of morticians, the white gloves of policemen, the bulky, fur-lined ones of polar explorers, the trim dark gauntlets of chauffeurs, the gloves of hunters with separate stalls only for thumb and trigger finger, the mittens of ice skaters and sleigh riders, old lady mitts without any fingers at all, the thin, translucent, elastic gloves of surgeons wielding flashing scalpels of silver-bright steel, a veritable whirlpool of gloves that finally led me down, down, down to darkness. Once again I woke with a start, as if I'd been touched, and shot up. Once again I felt something about 4 inches long clinging high on my neck, only this time under the other ear. Once again I frantically slashed at my neck and jaw, stinging them painfully, only this time I struck upward and away. I thought I felt something go. I got the light on and checked the door at once. It was securely shut. Then I looked at the table by the open window. The heavy ashtray still sat in the center of it, rock firm. But the rapist glove that had been under it was gone. I must have stood there a couple of minutes, telling myself this could not be. Then I went over and lifted the ashtray and carefully inspected its underside. as if the glove had somehow managed to shrink and was clinging there. And all the while, I was having this vision of the glove painfully humping itself from under the ashtray and inching to the table's edge and dropping to the floor and then crawling off almost anywhere. Believe me, I searched my place then, especially the floor. I even opened the doors to the closet and the clothes cabinet, though they had been tightly shut, and searched the floor there. And of course I searched under and behind the bed. And more than once, while I searched, I'd suddenly jerk around thinking I'd seen something gray approaching my shoulders from behind. There wasn't a sign of the glove. It was dawn by now. Had been for some time. I made coffee and tried to think rationally about it. It seemed to boil down to three explanations that weren't wildly far-fetched. First, that had gone out of my mind. Could be, I suppose. But from what I'd read and seen, most people who go crazy know damn well ahead of time that something frightening is happening to their minds, except maybe paranoics. Still, it remained a possibility. Second, that someone with a duplicate or master key had quietly taken the glove away while I was asleep. The apartment manager and janitor had such keys. I'd briefly given my duplicate to various people. Why, once before she got down on me, I'd given it to Evelyn Maine. Matter of letting someone in while I was at work. I thought I'd got it back from her, though I remember once having a second duplicate made. I'd forgotten why. The main difficulty about this explanation was motive. Who'd want to get the glove? Except the rapist, maybe? Third, of course, there was the supernatural. Gloves are ghostly to start with, envelopes for hands. And if there isn't a medieval superstition about wearing the flayed skin of another's hand to work magic, there ought to be. Of course, there was the Hand of Glory, its fingers flaming like candles, guaranteed to make people sleep while being burgled. But there the skin is still on the dry, chopped-off hand. And there are tales of spectral hands aplenty, pointing out buried treasure or hidden graves, or at guilty murderers, or carrying candles or daggers. So why not gloves? And could there be a kind of telekinesis in which a hand controls at a distance the movements and actions of a glove it has worn? Of course, that would be psychonics or whatnot. But to me, the parapsychological is supernatural. And in that case, what had the glove been trying to do probing at my neck? Strangle me, I think. And somewhere I'd read of an aristocratic Brazilian murderess of the last century who wore gloves woven of spider silk, and of a knight blinded at a crucial moment an attorney by a lady's silken glove worn as a favor. Yes, they were eerie envelopes, I thought, gloves were. But I was just concerned with one of them, a vanishing glove. I started with a jerk as there came a measured knock-knock. I opened the door and looked up at the poker face of two young policemen. Over their shoulders, Mr. Helpful was peering down eagerly at me, his lips rapidly quirking in little smiles, with what I call questioning pouts in between. Back and a little to one side was Marcia, looking shocked and staring intently at me through the narrow space between the second policeman and the door jamb. Jeff Winters, the first policeman, said to me, as if it were a fact that he was putting into place. It occurred to me that young policemen look very blocky around their narrow hips with all that equipment they carry snugly nested and cased in black leather. "Officer Hart," Marcia began anxiously. The second policeman's eyes flickered towards her, but just then the first policeman continued. "Your neighbor, Miss Everly, says she handed you a glove earlier this morning." And he stepped forward into the private space. I think it's sometimes called around my body, and I automatically stepped back. "We want it," he went on, continuing to step forward, and I back. I hesitated. What was I to say? That the glove had started to spook me and then disappeared? Officer Hart followed the first policeman in. Mr. Helpful followed him in and stopped just inside my door. Marcia, still beyond him, looked frantic. Officer Hart turned, as if about to tell Mr. Helpful to get out, but just then Officer Halsted, that was the other name Marcia had mentioned, said, "Well, you've still got it, haven't you? She gave it to you, didn't she?" I shook, then nodded my head, which must have made me look rattled. He came closer still and said harshly, and with a note of eagerness, "Well, where is it, then?" I had to look up quite sharply at him to see his face. Beyond it, just to one side of it, diagonally upward across the room, was the top of the tall clothes cabinet, and on the edge of that there balanced that damn gray glove, flat fingers dripping over. I froze. I could have sworn I glanced up there more than once, when I was hunting the thing and seen nothing, yet there it was, as if it had flown up there or else been flicked there by me the second time I'd violently brushed something from my face. Officer Halsted must have misread my look of terror, for he ducked his head toward mine and rasped, "Your neighbor, Mr. Angus, says that it's your glove, that he saw you wearing gray gloves night before last. What do you say?" But I didn't say anything, for at that moment the glove slid off its precarious perch and dropped straight down and landed on Mr. Helpful, Angus's shoulder close to its neck, just like the hand of an arresting cop. Now, it may have been that in ducking his head to look at it, he trapped it between his chin and collarbone, or it may have been, as it looked to me, that the glove actively clung to his neck and shoulder, resisting all his frantic efforts to peel it off, while he reiterated, his voice mounting in screams, "It's not my glove!" He took his hands away for a moment, and the glove dropped to the floor. He looked back and forth and saw the dawning expressions on the faces of the two policemen, and then, with a sort of despairing sob, he whipped a long knife from under his coat. Considerably to my surprise, I started toward him, but just then Officer Hart endeared himself to us all forever by wrapping his arms around Mr. Angus like a bear, one hand closing on the wrist of the hand holding the knife. I veered past him. I vividly recall changing the length of one of my strides so as not to step on the glove, and reached Marcia just in time to steady her as she turned quite white. She swayed, her eyelids fluttering. I heard the knife clatter to the floor. I turned my arms around Marcia, and we both saw Mr. Angus seem to shrink and collapse in Officer Hart's ursine embrace, his face going gray as if he were an empty glove himself. That was it. They found the other glove and the long silver wig in a locked suitcase in his room. Marcia stayed frightened long enough, off and on, for us to become better acquainted and cement our friendship. Officer, now Detective Hart, tells us that Mr. Angus is a model prisoner at the hospital for the criminally insane, and has gone very religious, but never smiles. And he, Hart, now has the glove in a sort of black museum down at the station, where it has never again been seen to move under its own power, if it ever did. One interesting thing. The gloves had belonged to Mr. Angus's father, now deceased, who had been a judge.